B. Collins. Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. It's Thursday, February 21st, 2019. Inside the Beltway, the rumors abound and they are growing louder. That special counsel Robert Mueller is ready to submit a report to the brand new Attorney General Bill Barr. Now, I know many people who are eagerly anticipating this. They think that it's going to resolve everything and that Mueller's going to prove that Trump colluded with Russia, and boom, he will resign in disgrace within minutes. Well, I hate to warn you. I don't think it's going to happen that way. Even when Mueller does submit a report, Bill Barr gets to go through it. He gets to filter it, censor it, redact it. And then it will be presented to Congress in some modified form. What will it contain? A smoking gun? Proof of criminal behavior? The collusion that Trump has long denied? Well, we truly don't know. This is an American cliffhanger, better than Hollywood could produce for us. So after nearly 2 years, we expect to see some product from the up-to-now silent Bob Mueller. And we don't know whether he is going to recommend impeachment, indictment of the president after he leaves office, or some other possibility. Now, we do know that his office is winding down, or at least it is trimming. It once had 17 lawyers that Trump used to attack as all Democrats, and they're now a dozen who are remaining. And word is that some of those are reaching out to the places that they were grabbed from, other elements of the Justice Department, to say, hey, can I come back to my old desk? So those are the indications that are being reported. As always, there are no sources for the reports, and so we are left to trust in our corporate media outlets. But Neal Katyal, he was Obama's acting Solicitor General, and he was active in the Justice Department when Bill Clinton was the subject of the special prosecutor, and that was under a different law with different rules from what Bob Mueller is dealing with, and he helped write the rules. After the Special Counsel Act, the Special Prosecutor Act expired, Katyal and others put together the rules, and he says that the report is unlikely to be lengthy by design. The special counsel regulations, which Katyal says I had the privilege of drafting in 1999, envision a report that is concise, a summary of what he found. And because of the limited mandate, he was ordered to investigate potential ties between the Trump campaign and some Russians, and to investigate obstruction of justice related to those and perhaps other investigations. So the regulations require the AG to give Congress a report, but it doesn't specify how much of the original special counsel's material has to be included there. And the general understanding is that if behavior doesn't lead to criminal charges, it will not be reported in the public mode. So in an op-ed in today's New York Times, Katyal says, the investigation resembles the architecture of the Internet, with many different nodes, and some of those nodes possess potentially unlimited jurisdiction. Their powers and scope go well beyond Mueller's circumscribed mandate. They go to Trump's judgment, whether he lied to the American people. But where does all that go? So far, there is no impeachment committee to receive such a report. And since I just said that, I'll quote Katyal. There is presently no open impeachment inquiry. That could quickly change if Mueller writes a report that is anything less than a full clearing of the president. Congress would be under a constitutional obligation to investigate the facts for itself. Well, I believe it is obliged. I don't think that this is optional in this case. And that's the way the Democrats have played it, including Gerald Nadler, who now chairs the Judiciary Committee, and Speaker Pelosi. And Katyal closes his op-ed thusly. This news may be disappointing for various reasons to the president's critics and supporters alike, but the ultimate result is a good one. It means the truth is likely to come out, maybe not on the timetable anyone wants, but it will. So whenever Mueller turns over his report, do not assume that things are over. The investigations here serve a purpose that transcends any one individual or law enforcement entity. This is the architecture of our Constitution, designed to ferret out high-level wrongdoing through a variety of channels for the American public to see. I consider that to be happy talk, Neil. And I hope you're right. I'd like to be happy. Meanwhile, with Rod Rosenstein stepping down as Deputy Attorney General, the number two at the Justice Department, it appears that some savings are in the offing, because they can just drop the Stein from all of those name placards that they spread all over the place, because Rosenstein is being replaced by Rosen. That would be Jeffrey Rosen, longtime litigator, Deputy Transportation Secretary, served in the Bush White House as General Counsel, Senior Policy Advisor. So he is a movement Republican. He once worked for the same law firm that Bill Barr just came from, Kirkland and Ellis, and that doesn't necessarily mean that much. So I don't know much about this guy, but he is the new Deputy Attorney General. So today I'm releasing a new in-depth interview to my subscribers at peterbcollins.com, TuneIn, iTunes, Spreaker, and Stitcher with James Bamford. He is the acknowledged expert on our intelligence community and particularly on the NSA. He's written a trilogy of books about his investigations. And as I reported last week, he published a lengthy article at the New Republic asserting that everything we know just about regarding Maria Butina, the Russian woman with ties to the NRA, who posed for pictures, asked Trump a question during the campaign, almost everything we know about her is bullshit. And the federal prosecutors who were not part of Mueller's operation, this is an important distinction that Bamford makes. Apparently Mueller passed on prosecuting Maria Butina. And then it was picked up by the federal prosecutor's office in the District of Columbia under Greg Mizell. He's the one who staged the arrest 2 days after Mueller indicted 13 GRU officers last July. Many people thought those were connected events. Trump met with Putin in Helsinki the day after Butina was picked up. And according to Bamford, they're not related. Butina is not a spy. She is simply an idealistic young Russian who ended up implicated in this scandal. Here's an excerpt from my conversation with Jim Bamford where he talks about all of the issues that the prosecutor has walked back after asserting them against Maria Butina, who remains in custody.
Well, they walked back basically everything. Yeah, they walked back the sex allegations, which were totally off the wall. They were basically, not basically, there were lies that the prosecution told in court. They walked back the whole idea of her getting her education as part of a cover, a Russian cover. They walked back the whole idea of her boyfriend as part of some sex plot to seduce him in order to get into the Republican party and all that, or Republican politicians and so forth. So they've walked back basically everything. All she ended up, they basically threw out those charges, and then all she pled to was a conspiracy charge, which was the lesser of the two charges. And she only did that after 4 months in solitary confinement.
That's Jim Bamford. I encourage you to listen to the full interview. It runs almost an hour, and he's got a lot to talk about. And he pulls back the curtain on this theatrical prosecution of the redhead Maria Butina. And I want to point out, I encourage you to listen all the way to the end, because I asked Jim Bamford about his comments on Bill Binney's theory that the DNC was the subject of a leak and not a hack. And Bamford, who's known Binney longer than I have and respects him, is dismissive of the idea. He kind of dismisses it as a conspiracy theory and, in my view, embraces the consensus conspiracy theory. But I do not try to censor the comments of the people I interview here. I respect the intelligence of my listeners and your ability to decide for yourselves. So please do listen to Bamford's comments. And I want to note that just in the last 24 hours, I've received some correspondence. One from a new listener in Texas. We'll call her Mary Sue because that's her name. And she said she likes listening to the podcast. She enjoyed the interview with Dr. Justin Frank, the author of Trump on the Couch. And she says she doesn't agree with my skepticism about Russian meddling in our election. And I welcome people to listen to this podcast who don't agree with me. It's not required. I don't expect it. And I'll note that when I went to the P.O. box yesterday, I picked up annual renewals from Keita Tom in Oregon, who says, keep up the good work on your view of the Russiagate scandal. And in lengthy comments, handwritten by Andy Drawl, a longtime listener to this podcast, going back to the very beginning, he renewed his annual subscription with some compliments, including on my Russia coverage, and much criticism. And I appreciate thoughtful criticism from listeners who listen to me critically, the same way I listen critically to other people. And while we're on the subject, I want to mention that I did exaggerate a little bit in yesterday's podcast headline when I wrote, millions bet $27 on Bernie. The actual number is a couple hundred thousand so far. So I admit I got carried away there, and I do adjust that headline. But I want to thank Andy and Keita and Mary Sue for her new subscription. That's what greases the operation here and keeps it all going at peterbcollins.com. I couldn't do it without your support, and so I encourage you to either continue supporting, renew your support, or begin supporting, whichever applies to you. And if you want to get started, just visit peterbcollins.com. You click menu, click become a subscriber, boom, you're on the sign-up page, and there you can make choices. You don't like PayPal? That's okay with me. You can communicate with Forever Stamps via the U.S. mail. My address, Box 150-660, San Rafael, California, 94915. Now, this next report from Politico, I consider to be speculative and based on dubious evidence. Once again, I think you deserve to know it so that you can decide for yourselves. What they report, a coordinated barrage of social media attacks on Democratic 2020 candidates suggests the involvement of foreign state actors. And they review that since Kamala Harris, Elizabeth Warren, and Bernie Sanders have announced, and the speculation around Beto O'Rourke of Texas, that they have been the subject of disinformation campaigns online that distort their positions and attempt to divide Democrats about these candidates. Now, there are many potential explanations here, and it is possible that bots controlled by offshore governments, which could include Russia but would not exclude others, may be trying to amplify the criticism that's raised by honorable residents of these United States. And since I don't spend much time on Twitter, Facebook is a better barometer for me. And what I see there is a lot of the people who I know who are not Russians, they are not bot-driven, they're articulating criticisms of these candidates, including the one described as racist and sexist, aimed at Kamala Harris. The pure fact that she had an intimate relationship with a married man, the former mayor of San Francisco, Willie Brown. They have never attempted to hide it. It is a known fact in the universe. But when it is trotted out, either in defense of or in criticism of Senator Kamala Harris, it's treated as disinformation and an attack. And that's just one reason why I'm skeptical of this reporting from Politico. A racially charged tweet was directed at Beto O'Rourke. The Twitter profile of the user where it originated indicates that the account was created last May, but it only issued one tweet in January of this year. And the attack on O'Rourke, as it's described, garnered 1.3 million potential impressions on Twitter. Now, those are weasel words, friends. Potential impressions? That means somebody scrolled past it. They didn't engage with it, and they may have read it, they may not have. So I think there's a lot of hot air here. And let's agree that we must first resolve the issues and either clear or convict domestic actors before we start fishing for interference from Russia or anywhere else. And central to this is the now proven election fraud in the 9th District, Congressional District, of the state of North Carolina. Because just moments before I sat down behind this microphone, the North Carolina State Board of Elections issued a unanimous ruling ordering a new election in this case. Quote, "It's become clear that the public's confidence in the general election has been undermined to an extent that a new election is warranted." And that is a comment from the Republican candidate who was declared the winner on or after the election day. And, of course, this centers around this murky character named Dowless, who was paying people to distribute absentee ballots to pick them up. They were submitted in batches. And this is true election fraud committed by Americans. And I know I'm being repetitive here. But this is treated as just some kind of an outlier. Wow, how did this happen in North Carolina? The state has gamed the Supreme Court's overturn of the active ingredient of the Voting Rights Act and used every potential element of voter suppression available under our system. And this is not the only place where election fraud has occurred. But that's how the media treats it, and it only enables smoke screens for the domestic actors to continue to disrupt our elections and manipulate them going into the future. And one of the remarkable elements of this review in the 9th District in North Carolina is that the son of Mark Harris, the congressional candidate who was named the winner, who now agrees there should be a new election, the son is a 29-year-old assistant U.S. attorney in Raleigh whose name is John Harris. And he was testifying before this commission. His voice cracked. His dad was crying. As he testified, "I thought what he was doing was illegal, and I was right." That's John Harris talking about Dowless. "I had no reason to believe that my father actually knew or that my mother or any associate with the campaign had any knowledge. I think Dowless told them he wasn't doing any of this, and they believed him." But then he says, "I emailed my daddy, and I had reviewed Dowless' participation in the 2016 election, where more absentee ballots were requested than returned by a large margin. And the victory was attributed to absentee voters." So, I don't know if John Harris is telling the whole truth, but it was emotional testimony, and it helps us understand how these operations work. Every day we're hearing these reports, as you're about to hear one repeated, that the people of Venezuela do not have access to the basic necessities of life. And that's why this phony humanitarian convoy or caravan that is blocked by bridges at the southern border of Venezuela that it shares with Colombia. And all this attention is on the misery in Venezuela and why that brutal dictator Nicolas Maduro will not allow this Trojan horse to enter his nation. And Max Blumenthal, who is posting reports along with his colleagues at grayzoneproject.com in a joint effort with Mint Press News, he just delivered this video. And it begins with a biased report from CNN, as you will hear.
And what is on the plane are basic goods, things that aren't available or accessible in Venezuela, things like nutritional biscuits, toothpaste, toothbrushes, just basic commodities that aren't available or readily available to Venezuelans right now because of the regime that they're currently living under.
We're at a supermarket in Caracas called Gama. I feel lost in the supermarket. coming here in Caracas. This is cheeses, there's a lot of cheeses and meats here. People here like meat, and there's a lot of meats.
All the shelves are full. Plenty of wine is available.
Fish heads, roly-poly fish heads.
Now in the fish department.
Got, like, congealed meat. We got, like, so much meat.
Now in the freezer section.
I mean, now, a lot of tomato sauce.
These visuals are powerful. They refute the notion that there isn't anything available in Venezuela. Now, I haven't had a chance to listen to the full six-minute report, and I imagine that somewhere Max Blumenthal acknowledges that the inflation that has occurred in Venezuela means that these groceries are probably on the shelf because nobody can afford to buy them, or at least not average people. But it's not average people who are fomenting this coup. It is the wealthy whites who were in power until the Chavista revolution. And that's what doesn't get reported in corporate media in the United States. I've been avoiding the story of Jesse Smollett because, well, it didn't make sense to me. And we know better why today. Because the actor from Empire, a show I've never seen, is now a suspect in the incident of an alleged assault that occurred at the end of January. We now know it was staged by Jesse Smollett, who hired two bit actors from the TV show to get a rope and make a noose and to fake this attack on him in the real nice part, the near north side of downtown Chicago. And so he's now a suspect. And the police chief, who is hopping mad, his name is Eddie Johnson, he said that Smollett had taken advantage of the pain and anger of racism, draining resources that could have been used to investigate other crimes. I just wish the families of gun violence in this city got this much attention. And then the black police chief asked, why would anyone, especially an African-American man, use the symbolism of a noose to make false accusations? How could someone look at the hatred and suffering associated with that symbol and see an opportunity to manipulate that symbol to further his own public profile? And we're told that the motive behind all this is that Jesse Smollett wanted a raise from the producers of the show that airs on Fox. Another plot that has been busted up, and I want to say at the get-go, in the initial reporting, I see no indication of a paid FBI informant in this case. It could be a freestanding case of attempted domestic terrorism. In custody is Coast Guard Lieutenant Christopher Paul Hassan, age 49, arrested last Friday on gun and drug charges. They looked at his computer, where they found a note, quote, I'm dreaming of a way to kill almost every last person on the earth. I think a plague would be most successful, but how do I acquire Spanish flu, botulism, or anthrax? Not sure, but we'll find out. So here we have a uniformed guy, self-described as a white supremacist for years, serving in the highest ranks at the headquarters of the Coast Guard, which is one of the 17 intelligence agencies that did not clear Hillary Clinton. Anyway, they say that Hassan has been stockpiling weapons since 2017, and that he conducted online searches, made lists of Democratic leaders, of media figures, made notes about applying thermite to a gas station tank, conducted online searches, made thousands of visits for pro-Russian, neo-fascist, and neo-Nazi literature. That's what has been officially reported at the time of his arrest and processing. Over in Britain, the Labour Party has suffered some losses as members jumped, and some of them were protesting, I believe, that Jeremy Corbyn, the leader of the party, had failed to provide any alternative. He was opposed to Theresa May's Brexit plan, but basically has just let her twist in the wind. So Corbyn has come forward with some proposals. He wants to hold a second referendum, and from here, that seems sensible to me. And he also wants to set up what essentially would be border rules or trade rules that would be less ambitious than the full Brexit package. Corbyn said, "We put forward what we believe to be a credible process to negotiate a customs union with the European Union, an alignment to ensure market access. We're strongly of the belief that these proposals are credible. That's been confirmed by our meetings today with the EU. The problem is the Prime Minister is insisting on her deal, which has already been defeated very heavily in Parliament, and running down the clock by trying to keep the threat of no deal on the table with all the damage that that does." I am linking to a powerful video. It generated quite a few laughs from me. Background first. Rutger Bregman is the Dutch historian who speaks really good English, and he attracted a lot of attention because he went to the Billionaire Summit in Davos and said, "Hey, how come nobody here talks about taxes?" So Tucker Carlson, who is kind of the wild card on Fox News, he doesn't always toe the party line, he invited Bregman on his show. But the interview went awry because Bregman insisted on criticizing Tucker Carlson himself. He said, "You're a millionaire funded by billionaires. You're not part of the solution. You're part of the problem, actually." And in the clip, and I want to thank Fred for sending it in, you're going to see Bregman, but you'll only hear the audio feed from Carlson at Fox in New York. So we don't get to see his reaction. But at the end, that little mother, Tucker Carlson, descends into name-calling, says that Bregman is a moron, and tells him to go fuck yourself. It's worth a watch. 6 minutes, you'll enjoy it. The Council on American Islamic Relations has filed a constitutional challenge to the government's use of the terrorist watch list. You can get on, but you can never get off. You'll never know why you're on it. And it is a police state tactic that deserves to be exposed and dismantled. And the FBI has been lying about this for years, claiming that they don't share the names on the terrorist watch list with outside groups. And now comes the revelation that 1,400 universities, hospitals, and other entities have access to the terrorist watch list. In depositions and court hearings, government officials had denied until very recently that the watch list compiled by the FBI's Terrorist Screening Center is shared with private entities. But now we know that the FBI often tells big fat lies. Interesting analytical piece in today's New York Times that concludes that, as it is outlined, the Green New Deal is technologically possible. It would be expensive, and we have to overcome many internal political barriers. But I think it's a fascinating piece. I've linked to it in the show file. Please read it. What we come away with is clear understanding that the technology is there. We may not be able to achieve zero carbon within 10 years, but one expert, Holdren from Harvard, says that we could do it by 2045 or 2050 if we get going now. And, of course, there's plenty to attack in the Green New Deal if you hate socialism and you don't want to protect workers or housing issues. But Mark Jacobson, a Stanford professor of civil and environmental engineering, says that 80% of the Green New Deal's target of net zero greenhouse emissions across the country could be achieved by 2030, 100% between 2040 and 2050. The big issue here is, how do we pay for it? And as I mentioned yesterday, somebody has got to say, cut the Pentagon budget. That's where the money is, and that's where we have to take it from. The Trump White House has announced they're establishing a panel to look at climate change. Don't get your hopes up. The 12-member Presidential Committee on Climate Security includes William Happer, the Princeton physicist who kisses Trump's ass and says that actually more carbon dioxide is beneficial to humanity and the Earth. So we won't expect much from that. And finally today, Naomi Klein defined disaster capitalism as it is exported from the United States. But Wall Street is poised, based on the Trump tax cut bill of 2017, to develop what are called opportunity funds. And, as we recall, Chris Hedges described the areas of the United States that have been exploited, polluted, and abandoned as sacrifice zones. And so we have 80 of these funds that have sprung up since January of last year. Even the Mooch, Anthony Scaramucci, is setting up a hedge fund to exploit these great opportunities. And you'll hear them talk about the humanitarian side, how it's going to be helpful to these distressed communities. And if you believe that, well, hey, thanks for listening. You can share this podcast anywhere. You'll find it on YouTube. I'm Peter B.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.